I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome to the Fried Egg Golf Podcast. I'm Garrett Morrison, and today we're doing takeaways from the 2023 Ryder Cup. The U.S. has suffered yet another loss at the hands of the European team in Europe, and we're going to break it all down for you in this episode. Who played well, who didn't, which decisions by the captains worked out, and which failed miserably, all that good stuff. In the back half of the episode, I'll talk to Ben Coley of SportingLife.com about all things Team Europe. But first up is Joseph LaMagna, a contributor to Fried Egg Golf. And Joseph and I are going to perform a kind of postmortem for Team USA. That's coming up right after this break. This episode of the Fried Egg Golf Podcast is brought to you by Gooder. Gooder makes $25 active sunglasses that don't slip, don't bounce, and are 100% polarized. My favorite pair is called Just Knock It On. They're in what Gooder calls the BFG style. Basically, they're for large noggins. I wear them all the time. I wore them earlier today when I was outside taking my walk in the morning. I basically wear them whatever I'm doing. These have been staples in my wardrobe. I don't know if you would call it a wardrobe when it comes to sunglasses, but they've been staples for me for months now. I recently took them out stand-up paddleboarding and kayaking, and they worked beautifully for that purpose. They're 100% polarized. They're very light. They just kind of sit comfortably on my face and are very steady. And you don't have to be precious about them because they're just $25. So if you want to support the show and pick up a pair, Gooder is giving Fried Egg listeners free shipping on your first order. You can go to gooder.com/TFE and use code TFE to get free shipping. Gooder offers a 30-day money-back guarantee and 100% satisfaction. So find your pair at goodr.com/TFE and use code TFE to get free shipping. Joseph LaMagna is here with me to perform a little autopsy of Team USA. Are you ready for that, Joseph?
Oh, I'm ready for that, Garrett. Let's do it.
Okay. All right. So why don't we start with the players? There's a lot of focus on the captains, and for good reason. And you have always interesting things to say about captain strategy, picks, pairings, things like that. There's plenty to get into on the American side there. But why don't we start with the players? Just to make it clear that the players are accountable here, that this doesn't all rest on Zach Johnson. Who were the biggest disappointments in your mind at this Ryder Cup for Team USA?
Yeah, it's hard to separate that from some of the captain's picks specifically, but the way that I would frame this entire Ryder Cup, some people don't want to hear this, I guess, on the European side, but Team USA was deeper. And the path to them losing was going to be bad play and some bad captaincy, some combination of both. But basically both had to happen for them to lose, in my opinion. And we got both. So the players, absolutely, like, there should be some accountability. There were some massive disappointments. I think Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, Colin Morikawa, Xander Schauffele, Wyndham Clark, a number of players just didn't step up and perform. Some of that is a function of where they were positioned, though. And so when we look at something like strokes gained, for example, because that's something that it's one of the only things that people really can look at during the Ryder Cup to evaluate how players performed, which I appreciate that we're doing that instead of like number of birdies or something. But Ryder Cup strokes gained data is really noisy. A lot of players don't even make it to certain holes. So it's kind of hard to only look at that. And it's also a function of the positions you were put in. If you're in foursomes, if you're in the alternate shot, and you're a bad approach player and you were hitting a bunch of long iron approach shots, your strokes gained isn't going to look very good. So I think the best way is to actually evaluate the pairings, click through the shots, see what the shots people actually hit on the leaderboard. And that's an effective way of evaluating who played well and who didn't, not just reducing it down to strokes gained.
Okay, so who did play well? What were some of the bright spots on the U.S. team, places where the team could eventually build?
I mean, the Max Homa played excellent. Brian Harman, they got some points. So
yeah, Brian Harman was paired with Max Homa for three sessions, was it?
Homa and Harman played together three sessions, yes.
Yeah, and then Harman lost his singles match, and so you could argue that Max Homa kind of carried Brian Harman, but having watched the matches, Harman made his contributions there.
Yeah, Harman played well. Scottie Scheffler, I think, was better than he was given credit for.
Really?
I don't think the match that they got crushed, 9-7, where he was partnered with Brooks, and I think we should talk about some of the decisions that went into them being paired together. Like I definitely want to get into that. I don't think Scottie played as poorly as it may look, which is hard to say given that they lost 9-7. But if you click through and look at his shot trails, he wasn't egregious in that match. Brooks was really bad. And the other player, I mean, you got to call out Patrick Cantlay, who played maybe the three most memorable holes of golf in 2023. The way that Patrick Cantlay closed out that Saturday four balls match where he was partnered with Wyndham Clark to take down Fitzpatrick and Rory is some of the best golf that I saw all year. So on the American side, that would be a high level overview of who played well.
And, you know, given the context of what was going on with Patrick Cantlay this week, obviously very, very impressive to see him step up. And, you know, I think that some of the reports that he was distant from the team or that he was complaining about not getting paid, I think there's a lot of validity to those reports. You know, it maybe not all the details are fully in place yet. We'll find out more in the coming weeks, but I think that there's enough smoke there to say that there's a fire. But his performance, especially on Saturday and Sunday, would suggest that for him at least, some of this noise around not being part of the team at least didn't affect his play. And so that's pretty interesting. All right. I can tell that you want to get into the captain's decisions. Zach Johnson really, it became clear as the week unfolded that the U.S. players weren't being put in their optimal positions to play well. Why don't we start with the captain's picks, right? Because that's the first set of like really major strategic captain's decisions. And then we can get to the pairings. But in retrospect, I know that a lot of this is Monday morning quarterbacking. You have made sure to comment on a lot of this stuff ahead of time. I don't do as much of that because, like, I don't think I'm an expert on this kind of stuff. And I always just assume that the people making these decisions know more than I do. And so I can look back and say, hey, this was wrong, this was right. But I don't really feel expert enough to comment beforehand. You have. And you made some pretty good calls ahead of time. So both in retrospect and when the picks were made, what some of your thinking was, how would you evaluate those captain's picks?
Yeah, I think I made some good calls and some bad calls. And what's important to me is to make them ahead of time, because after the event goes down, everyone has thoughts for Zach Johnson. And I even tweeted on Friday after those first two sessions, like, I think Zach Johnson's bearing a little more blame than he should. Golfers really didn't play well, which I stand behind. But Zach Johnson deserves,
especially in that first foursome session, right? Where it's like, I mean, whatever position they were put in, they would have lost.
Yeah, too much of the blame, and maybe credit, but more importantly, too much of the blame goes on the captains in some of these situations. But that said, I still think Zach Johnson deserves an enormous amount of criticism for the way he handled this start to finish. The biggest thing on the captain's picks, we can argue so many different names. I don't think anyone can argue that Cameron Young shouldn't have been on this team. This golf course demanded great driving and long iron play, and that is what Cameron Young does to a tee. There is no world where you leave Cameron Young off this team. And it's impossible to say, hey, he for sure would have played well. But he's the type of player that could have gone out there and got 4 points for Team USA. I mean, I'm not saying that he would have for sure. Obviously, I can't say that, but Cameron Young absolutely should have been on this team. There's no doubt about it.
All right. So Cameron Young should have been on. Then who should have been off? What spot is he taking?
Yeah, and I've heard the point made, like, why didn't we give more critique to Ricky Fowler? We kind of just shooed him in. I think the way that Ricky and Spieth had played, it was going to be really hard to leave either of them off of the team. Sam Burns was a bad fit for this golf course, and that I would have absolutely taken Cam Young over Sam Burns. I wouldn't have had to think hard about that one. Sam Burns actually played a little better, especially the back half of this, the final 2 days, than I might have expected him to. He's a great player, but Cam Young, no doubt I'm taking him over Sam Burns. The Justin Thomas conversation is just much more, like, I would have taken Cam Young over Justin Thomas and said that at the time. I do think there's something to the team chemistry and Justin Thomas bringing some energy, bringing some flair to the event, getting guys engaged, and there's value to that. But, I mean, the performance was really bad, as I would have expected. And a huge story here is that with both Sam Burns and Justin Thomas, those are players who make a lot of their money with a wedge in their hand. And this was not a golf course where you're going to be hitting wedge very often. So that's kind of a transition a little bit into the pairing stuff. Can we go into that?
Yeah, well, I mean, Sam Burns, I think that we can pretty much almost certainly say that he was picked because he was going to be paired with Scottie Scheffler, right? And so that pairing was preordained. That was a captain's pick pairing, right? But both of those were considered together. He was inevitably going to be playing with Scottie Scheffler. I mean, what did you make of that pairing?
Yeah, so, like, I think there was a very clear formula to this Ryder Cup, and the Europeans followed it. You needed a great driver off of the even numbered holes, and you needed a really good approach player off of the odd holes. Okay, because as the second shot on a lot of the even numbered holes, you're going to hit a lot of long irons. You were also going to have three of the par threes. So, good long iron player off the odd holes. You're going to have driver in your hand a lot on the even numbered holes. Good driver needs to tee off there. And when you start to look at this United States team and say, well, who are the truly great drivers of the golf ball? It's a pretty interesting conversation. And another important thing to comment on the foursomes, because we're specifically talking about the alternate shot, the foursomes format. That is a format where you need to have your best golfers on the course. When they hit a bad shot, you're almost certainly going to lose the hole. Versus in four balls, in the best ball format, you can get away with hitting a lot of bad shots. And you see that, all due respect to Bobby McIntyre, that's what the Europeans did. They hit him in the best ball format, as you should. So to take a step back and say, well, who are the great drivers on the American team? For example, two of the best drivers are Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay. But we just took it for granted that they're going to pair together. And there's not even a conversation of, hey, you know what? Maybe we should split these two up and ensure that we have good drivers on all of these teams. So that's a natural place to talk about the Scottie Scheffler-Sam Burns pairing, where Scottie Scheffler is one of the great drivers of the golf ball on Team USA, but you wanted him hitting all these important approach shots. Therefore, they had him go off the odd numbered holes. Well, that leaves Sam Burns, a bad driver of the golf. Not bad, but he's not one of the top drivers. He can spray it. He's going off the even numbered holes. That's a bad pairing. They're going to have issues all day. Xander and Patrick Cantlay, right? They didn't even get a point, and we stacked two of the best drivers on the team on the same foursomes pairing. And then we had, on Saturday, they played Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas, neither of whom is a good driver of the golf ball right now, and they're both shaky with their long irons. That was a disastrous pairing. So these pieces all fit together, and when you see the way Europe did it, for example, with the Victor Hovland, Ludvig Åberg pairing, it was much more well done, and we got to have a conversation about the role that Buddy Ball played, because the Sam Burns-Scheffler pairing, and then insisting on Cantlay and Schauffele being paired together, it imposes these artificial constraints, and you want to have maximum flexibility.
Now, okay, in Zach Johnson's defense, some of these pairings had been successful in the past, right? At Whistling Straits, some of these specific pairings were pretty dominant, and Spieth and Thomas clearly have a history of playing quite well together. And so how do you make the decision, if you're Zach Johnson, to go away from that in this particular instance?
I put a lot less stock into those kinds of things because they're different golf courses and those players' skill sets look a lot different at that time. So when people want to say, well, you got to take Justin Thomas on the team because of his small sample size record in Ryder Cups, then what do you say now when he just put a couple losses in the column? Does he have a good record still? And the conversation starts to get hairy. I would focus way more on what are the shots that are going to be hit and who are the players best equipped to hit those shots, which is, I think, a really important point about the chemistry and the makeup and the spirit of Team USA versus Team Europe. I believe firmly that the Team Europe says, hey, just give me a player that's going to be complementary with my skill set and we'll go make it happen. And I've heard plenty of anecdotes about that. Henrik Stenson had said that when he was playing. Justin Rose came out this week and said, you know, playing a good pairing doesn't necessarily mean playing with your best friend or whatever he said. I think Team Europe just takes that approach more in general versus Team USA. I think the players are dictating a little bit more of that. And I would not be scared to break up pairings that have done well in the past. And I don't think Team Europe's scared to do that either.
I really agree with that. And I think that a great representation of that dynamic was just in the Friday foursomes matchups, where you had going first out Scheffler and Burns, buddy ball. You had Xander Cantlay batting cleanup, right, in the fourth match of that session. Going up against Scheffler and Burns for Team Europe was John Rahm and Tyrrell Hatton. And Rahm said something during the week to the effect of, well, I've gotten a lot more familiar with Tyrrell over the past few weeks. As in, we didn't really know each other that well before we heard that we might be paired up in this Ryder Cup and we might have to get familiar with each other. I think that that's a great example of how Team Europe isn't as guided by these traditional pairings, buddy ball, whatever you want to call it. There just aren't these pairs that you can't break up. It's almost like Team USA is imposing certain constraints on itself, saying that we can make whatever decision we want, except we can never split up Spieth and Thomas. We can never split up Burns and Scheffler. We can never split up Xander and Cantlay. We just can't do that. But anything else we can do, well, you've already really limited your decision-making. And that doesn't mean that you make these last-minute decisions in a hectic state of panic and that you put two guys together who didn't expect to be together. That's not clearly what happened with Team Europe. But there was a plan for the European team, and that plan doesn't appear to have been guided by what the pre-existing friendships were. And that seems to be the core of the difference when it comes to the pairings philosophy here. Rahm and Hatton, what do those guys have to do with each other? I mean, the personalities might seem to kind of be similar to each other in some ways, but I don't think those guys were buddies. But they, I guess Dodo Molinari probably saw something in their games for this course where he was like, yeah, these guys should go out.
Yeah, and I think a great example of Europe sticking to their game plan and abandoning any kind of artificial constraints. Garrett, so I think you can make an argument that foursomes is more important, right? Each shot is more important, and you need to have your talent on the golf course when you're in the foursomes format.
Yeah,
right?
You need to avoid mistakes. You just need to, in foursomes, mistakes are deadly. Four ball mistakes are manageable.
That's a good way of putting it, right? And already mentioned that that's what they did with Bobby McIntyre. That's what Europe did. Of the foursomes pairings, Garrett, on between Friday and Saturday, how many of those teams do you think were the same for Team USA? And how many of those teams were identical from Friday to Saturday for Team Europe?
3-1 or something like that.
Europe's teams were identical both days of the alternate shot. And I don't even know if anyone's brought that up, but they were the exact same. McIlroy, Fleetwood, Straka, Lowry, Hovland, Oberg, and Rahm Hatton. And that is, to me, a signal of intelligent pairing and sticking to a game plan. But Team USA, they're mixing them up.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so foursomes is kind of like a specialty. And it's like, we gotta identify the guys who are going to thrive in this format and use them both times.
And they're going to be our best players.
Right. And it's got to be the guys who are making the fewest mistakes. And if you were to just look at Team USA and try to consider who's making the fewest mistakes right now, you probably wouldn't choose Ricky Fowler. I mean, it wouldn't take long to determine that he's probably making some mistakes. Did he end up only playing in two sessions, Ricky?
Yeah. He played the singles and then he played one on the Friday, which was
he played that foursomes match.
Exactly.
And so that just tells you right there. I mean, here's a guy who's only playing in two sessions. Basically, they're hiding Ricky. They knew they needed to hide Ricky. And so why are you putting him in a foursomes match if you want to hide him? If you want to hide somebody, as you said, with Bob McIntyre, you know, four ball is sort of the way to do it.
And okay, one other thing on that point, there are certain skill sets that interact, and mm-hmm. wedge and putter is one of those, right? If you're hitting a lot of good wedges, you're giving yourself short range putts, which is where the best putters in the world, they capitalize. Sam Burns is an excellent example of a player who has that wedge putter interaction. Really good wedge player, really good putter. When you put him in alternate shot with Scottie Scheffler, those skill sets no longer interact. There aren't a lot of wedges, but when there are, he's going to hit some wedges close that Scottie Scheffler is notoriously struggling with his putter, and he's not going to cash them in. Also, in the best ball format, you let Sam Burns, you let those skill sets interact. Right on the first hole, when he played four balls on Saturday, it's a short par four, it's like 407 yards. He hit a 3-wood off the tee, hit a wedge in close, made the putt. Those skill sets interacted in the best ball format. You're not allowing them to interact in the alternate shot format. And that is where it's just another example of why Sam Burns, if he's only going to play two sessions, put him in the four balls both times. He's probably going to be one of the weaker links on Team USA, and his skill set's better suited for it. Do that, right? And if you pair him with Scottie Scheffler, who's not an amazing, he's a good wedge player, but not an amazing putter, you're probably going to make birdies on different holes. That's the way to pair players. Instead, they went with him in foursomes, which didn't make any sense. Does that make sense, Garrett?
That totally makes sense, right? It's sort of like each player has a really unique skill profile and a way that they get things done. And some of those skill profiles lend themselves to foursomes more than others. You know, if a guy is a great driver of the ball and a great putter, that might be a pretty cool combination for a foursomes player. But when you have somebody like Sam Burns, who's making so much of his money just inside 100 yards, then that's maybe not as fruitful. But that said, Burns did end up playing pretty well. We don't know what Cameron Young would have done. What would Cameron Young have done if paired with Scottie Scheffler? Maybe that wouldn't be the best pairing because neither of those guys can really putt right now. But whatever. I mean, this course, I think that you've said this before, this course didn't exactly prioritize putting. So there were other possibilities on the board for Team USA. Let's go back to the JT pick, though, because that's the interesting hinge for me here. Because when you're talking about Cameron Young, the guy he replaces on this team is Sam Burns, not JT. So I think that once you start talking about whether JT should have been on this team or not, you start considering players like Keegan Bradley, Russell Henley. Who am I forgetting?
Bryson.
Bryson. Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, then let's talk about it from... That's the most interesting way to talk about this is JT versus Bryson. That's the this is the juiciest. This might not be the right way to discuss it, but it's the juiciest way to discuss it. We can talk about Bryson and JT together. How do you make the decision to put Bryson on this team, given that he's been playing so much of his golf on a tour where the information that we're getting about what guys are doing competitively is a little bit, it's new at the very least. I don't know if it's unreliable, but when you compare it to what we get, the information that we get about how guys are playing on the PGA Tour, it's just got to be a little bit less credible. So how do you make the decision to put Bryson on this team over a guy like JT?
I wouldn't have put Bryson on the team, and you're speaking largely to why I wouldn't have. And I would have considered him. Brendan and I talked about that on an episode of The Shotgun Start. Like, yeah, you got to consider Bryson. But the data is limited. There are a bunch of golfers in the LIV fields that at this point, it's really hard to evaluate them. And so when you're trying to think about field strength of those LIV events, it's difficult. There's not crossover in those golfers, especially at the bottom of the LIV roster, playing a bunch of other events. You don't have a whole lot to go off of besides things like major championship performances. And Bryson wasn't exactly stellar in those. He struggled at the Open Championship, was decent at the U.S. Open, finished T20. The PGA Championship.
He was good at the PGA Championship.
He finished tied for fourth. Oak Hill, you could kind of spray it. That's a Bryson golf course, like very much winged foot type course. And then he missed the cut at the Masters. So he didn't give us a whole lot to go off of besides some big moments on the LIV tour, which are legitimately hard to evaluate. Do I think that Bryson would have given you a better chance than Justin Thomas? If you take out the team chemist, all that stuff, you just take out the team chemistry altogether. Yeah, probably. But it's really hard to, in my opinion, have full confidence in somebody with a really limited data set. Like, just for example, Bryson's driver, he has sprayed over the last 2 to 3 years. How much is he spraying it right now on LIV? I don't know. The data's not good enough to even evaluate that, right? You can't see how straight somebody's hitting the ball. So that's Bryson's, I don't know if I want to use the word fault, but it's a trade-off Bryson made by joining that tour.
Yeah. Now, JT didn't play well at this Ryder Cup, and so that means something, and we can hand out, you know, demerits and A grades to people's pre-Ryder Cup takes according to that. I know that's how it works, and that's fine. But the argument that I would make in defense of the JT pick right now is the same as the argument that I made before the Ryder Cup. And that is not necessarily that he is a team room galvanizer, that he's a great cheerleader or whatever. That some of that may be true. I can't really evaluate that. What I do think I know is that Justin Thomas has established himself as one of the best players of his generation over the course of his career. And everybody on the US team is aware of that. And so if he were not picked by Zach Johnson, and especially if his spot appeared to be taken by Bryson DeChambeau, there would have been some discontent and some ill feeling about that within the team, not because the guys like JT better, though that may be very much the truth, but because they think of him as one of the greatest players of his generation, and they want the best players on their team. Even if JT has had a miserable year, I still believe that guys like Max Homa, Patrick Cantlay, I still think they think of JT in the same way that they did in 2022 when JT won a major. And so I think that that is part of the logic of that pick that's not necessarily backed by valid recent data that is convincing to me. You know, this is you had to pick him in that spot because it just would have been weird to the team if you hadn't.
I don't disagree with you. And here's why I felt strongly that Justin Thomas was going to perform poorly. Over the last few months, he has given us very few strong performances. A couple of those were Fortinet, which is a lot of
Wyndham
wedges.
And Fortinet.
Yeah. A lot of wedges. Wyndham Championship, which is, again, like kind of a wedge and on and around the greens. That's sort of what Sedgefield tends to test. And the Travelers Championship, which was another like really soft setup, a lot of wedges in your hand. Outside of that, there's a lot of missed cuts and some really ugly data, right? Some almost last place in a couple majors. U.S. Open and the Open Championship were really bad. Finished T65 at the PGA, missed cuts at the cut at 3M, Memorial. I mean, there's a lot of bad data in there. None of the players on the U.S. team are following the data like that, right? It's not like Max Homa and Patrick Cantlay are going through that rationale. So I agree with you that if they didn't pick him, it probably would have taken some air out of the room a little bit, and no one's thinking mm-hmm. about the fact that the Fortinet's a wedge contest. Like, so I think they did kind of have to pick him, and even saying that, I wouldn't have. But I'm not mm-hmm. the captain of Team USA, and I don't even know how to think about some of the team chemistry stuff because I've never been in one of those rooms.
That's interesting. And I think that if you don't pick JT and you have the rationale that you're laying out right now, that you just need a captain who is really good and really authoritative in explaining to the team why this decision puts them in the best spot to win. Because I think that that's what those guys care about. There's this narrative out there that they care about having their buddies on the team and yucking it up in the team room. And I don't really think that that's what it's about. I think they all want to be in the best position to win. I think they don't want to be embarrassed. But they have a certain set of beliefs about which players around them are going to give them that best chance to win. And some of that is maybe based on personal feelings that they're not entirely aware of. And so you would have needed a leader who was really convincing and had a lot of credibility on the team to explain why JT is being left home in this situation. And I'm not sure that Zach Johnson was that guy this time. He just didn't appear to be. And that leads us to some of these team dynamics, some of the intangibles, some of the stuff that's really hard to discuss from the outside. You're somebody who's deep in the data and who is really conversant in that kind of stuff. You know, in your own thinking about the Ryder Cup, how often do you try to even bring in some of this soft science stuff, sports psychology, sports performance, things like that? How do you bring that into your thinking from the outside, evaluating a Ryder Cup performance? Can you even do that?
Really difficult. I am a believer in that stuff. I think you hear it from enough golfers that I trust them because they're smart. They are. They're some of the best people in the world at their craft. And I think it's really hard to... I watch a lot of sports, right? Not golf. Not just golf. Every sport. And it's pretty clear that team chemistry can be important. There are also other instances, like in professional basketball, where some guys don't like each other in the locker room. And winning seems to take care of everything. And yeah. I think I come a little bit from the mindset of give players a chance to let their performance lead. Because if you didn't have Justin Thomas on this team, I think there's an argument of, hey, who are the leaders in that team room? And that might be more of an indictment of some of the characters in that team room than... it is a valid point. Like who are the galvanizers if you remove Justin Thomas? And what I would say to that is, well, you wouldn't have said Patrick Cantlay going into this Ryder Cup. And he ended up being one because his clubs did a lot of the talking. There were some of the other storylines too, but I think it's unfair to penalize Cam Young for potentially a perceived lack of leadership, or you're giving Justin Thomas that leadership credit, but you're not giving it to Cameron Young. What if Cameron Young would have played and balled out and guys would have rallied around him? Like, it's hard for me to... Team chemistry is tough because just giving Justin Thomas that check in his giving him a tally for that, but not giving it to some other guys who haven't even had the chance to assert that right. doesn't necessarily feel 100% fair to me. The only other thing I'll say on that, and because I'm being long-winded on this answer, is that I think an important part of the intangibles, which maybe this shouldn't be considered an intangible, is rest. And rest slash preparation. And I do believe that the layoff the United States had leading into this Ryder Cup was a disadvantage. It's a little bit difficult to troubleshoot. Say, hey, more guys should have showed up for the Fortinet. No, I don't think that's the answer. I don't think showing up in Napa would have been an unbelievable, you know, way to prepare for this event. But even like rest, Garrett, in the fact that both Jon Rahm and Scottie Scheffler rested on Saturday afternoon, that was a signal they were going to be teeing off first in the singles match. These teams are thoughtful about that kind of stuff, and energy levels is something that should be considered. So the team chemistry and energy level stuff is really interesting, and that's not strokes gained stuff.
Right, and you need people around who know about that stuff. And I think, by the way, this is why Dodo Molinari is such a weapon.
Yep.
for the European side, because it seems like on the US side, this is an oversimplification, but to an extent, I think it's true that you have your data guys and you have your golf guys, and the two of them try to communicate and try to establish links in decision-making between the two camps, but maybe there's not a whole lot of people who can kind of sit in the middle and do both. Dodo Molinari can do both. He is everything at once. He is a widely respected professional golfer who speaks golfer, and also somebody who is deep, deep in the data and understands it. And so I think that's a major advantage for the European side here. Somebody who brings together the hard and soft sciences a bit. And then, you know, when it comes to team chemistry, it's so funny. There's so many different versions of teams that function well psychologically and collectively. And it's not just the teams who all like each other. It's really not. I mean, it's not that simple. I think that the common thread between teams that perform well together, and this is just speaking from my own, you know, very, very low level experience coaching and being an athlete, it's belief in the other guys. It's trust that they're great and that they're going to do their best for you. And yeah, some of that can create bonds of loyalty and friendship, but really it doesn't require that. And that's why you get certain teams that, you know, guys don't like each other very much, but they believe in each other. They believe that the other guy is a great player and is going to come through in big moments. Shaq and Kobe ended up blowing up, and maybe some of the interpersonal issues were a contributing factor to that. But the fact is that for a time, they were a great, great team without liking each other at all. And that's because both of those players believed that the other player was one of the best. And that was a fact that they couldn't ignore, and that provided enough, you know, trust and team chemistry to get things done. And so, you know, when it comes to the US team, I think that people maybe overstate the role that buddiness plays. What they've really got to have is other players that they really believe in. They've got to look for the best players for this particular course, and they've got a captain. They've got to have a captain who can articulate to players why certain decisions are being made. Why is this guy, why is this pairing going to be the best for me? And if you can make those arguments, then you're going to create much better team chemistry.
I think that was very well said. I totally agree with you. Belief, and part of belief is putting players in the best position to succeed. The only thing I'll add on that from an organization, I don't know, I'm not an expert in building an organization, and some of the, I don't have my MBA in organizational studies or whatever that specific.
Yeah, you need an MBA to be valid in this kind of
stuff. Right, right. But yeah. I think investment in the process is important when you're building an organization, and having the members of the team aligned on the mission and the decisions that are being made, which is a little bit of a slippery slope, because the more you involve the players in the decisions, the more they advocate for potentially some of their friends. And that is the fine line. So I totally agree with you. I think education is a big piece here, where the captain needs to understand this stuff, needs to explain to the players, like, I want some of your input on potentially who you think are good players, who would be good fits for the team room and stuff. Ultimately, I'm making the call, and I'll tell you why I'm making the call, and it's going to be data-driven, and we're going to get the course fit stuff right. And you need a unique skill set to be able to do both of those things, to pick the right players, to get buy-in from the team, but to not let the buy-in become a buddy system to where you roll out Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas in foursomes. And that is the balance that needs to be struck. And I agree with you that not just Dodo Molinari, who was excellent, but I think Luke Donald deserves an enormous amount of credit for the way that they navigated that entire equation.
All right. So coming up next in this podcast, I have Ben Coley on to discuss some of those European dynamics. But thank you so much, Joseph. Always a pleasure to have you on after a big event. And I guess we get a bit of a break now between now and the Masters.
Yeah, sounds good. I'll see you in 2 years at the Ryder Cup.
Thank you. I am here with Ben Coley. Ben, is this as glorious a victory as I am assuming it must be for everybody who lives in Europe?
I think so, yeah. It doesn't really get much better, I don't think. I mean, obviously, I probably would have said the same in 2018 and 2014 and 2010 and so on and so forth. I mean, my entire life has been European Ryder Cup victory, basically, which is fantastic, on home soil, at least.
No big deal.
But yeah, this is pretty sweet. I mean, in terms of where we were 2 years ago and where we are today, I mean, they've done exceptionally well. I know that a lot of the aftermath will be about the United States and their various failings, and a lot of that is valid. But I hope that there's still plenty of time and space to talk about how well Europe did, because I really don't think they missed a beat. I mean, I know captaincy is such that you win and everything was right and you lose and everything was wrong, but I don't think that's a long way from the truth here. So, a fabulous victory for Europe. And I kind of, like Luke Donald said when he was asked if he would do it again in 2 years, I don't really care about Bethpage right now. We're just enjoying what was a fantastic victory and one that was in no doubt, really, from a very early stage.
Well, let's start with the players, specifically the leading trio of Rory McIlroy, John Rahm, and Victor Hovland. Going into this Ryder Cup, I think almost everyone acknowledged that they were three of the four best golfers in the world, maybe the three best golfers in the world based on kind of recent form and complete game, because the other player in that mix might be Scottie Scheffler, who has sort of openly struggled with putting lately, whereas these three players have been more or less firing on all cylinders for this year of 2023. Tell me about their performances, their collective performance at this Ryder Cup, and what it meant to the European team.
Yeah, well, obviously, I think the timing in that respect was really, really good for Europe. Obviously, Victor coming off winning the FedEx Cup, and John finding his form again at Wentworth, and Rory obviously has barely missed a beat this year. But it was great to see Hovland in particular really confirm his ascent has been kind of on a nice steady trajectory. But 2 years ago, it was a little bit soon for him. And yet he played five games, and it really tells you a lot about that European side and the problems they had. I mean, it's easy to forget, but Tommy Fleetwood was not quite at his best. Matt Fitzpatrick was not the player he is now. Tyrrell Hatton, the same. And we had to rely on Victor without any choice. But this time it was clearly he was ready for it. And the way he played in the singles in particular, I mean, obviously guiding Ludwig through those foursomes matches on both mornings and the record win on Saturday was fantastic. But the way he went out and looked at simply a better player than Colin Morikawa, I think was a really nice sort of symbol of where those two players have gone over the last couple of years and their respective directions. John is just, I mean, he just loves it, doesn't he? I think he's got that wonderful balance of, I mean, we all hear him speak and he's so well grounded, but he's got a real chip on his shoulder as well. And I actually thought that watching him in the press conference last night, like you could see he was quietly fuming that no one was asking him questions and all the questions were going to Rory. He's sitting there thinking, look, I'm the best player in this team.
I could tell they were joking about it, but John was like, no, but really. I mean, and Rory kind of saved it a little bit at one point by saying, oh, he's only the best player in the world. And so that was a nice bit of diplomacy from Rory. But yes, it bothered him.
And it says so much about the European team that they're still fundamentally individual sports people, but they can put that aside. And John said it himself, you come into the team room on a Monday and it doesn't matter who you are. And we just only when the competition was finished, see that ego come back, right? Because he was fine with being sat out of Saturday afternoon, which is one of probably the two or three decisions that had things gone wrong on Sunday, obviously Luke Donald would have had to answer for. But as for Rory as well, I mean, you probably know, Garrett, that I'm a bit of a romantic and a massive Rory fanboy. So to say this week was just how I'd have wanted it to go is probably an understatement, even down to what happened on Saturday night and having that extra sort of twist to it. But he's a player who cares deeply about this competition. We know that he cares about the legacy he leaves behind. And it was his best Ryder Cup. And I was a little bit surprised he played all five matches. And I think a lot of people will be surprised that it was him and not John, who played fewer holes as well. and probably play better over those first three sessions. So I think that probably tells you something about Luke Donald, actually. And probably he spent a lot of time thinking about how best to get Rory firing, and actually saying to him after Whistling Straits that, no, you are going to play five. You are still my guy, was another little thing that Donald got absolutely right.
So looking at these past two Ryder Cups in retrospect, I admit that I didn't have this narrative in my mind going into this Ryder Cup, but looking at this European team and how it has shown up in 2021 and then in 2023, it seems like there's a bit of a changing of the guard going on, and Liv has a lot to do with that, because all of a sudden Sergio Garcia is not around, Ian Poulter's not around, Lee Westwood's not around, and they were all very much factors at Whistling Straits, and kind of now give the impression that that Whistling Straits Ryder Cup was kind of the last gasp of a particular era of the European Ryder Cup, and now we have a new looking team. But one holdover from the previous era is Justin Rose, and he had quite a week, sort of a surprising week in a lot of ways, although he's shown, you know, that he can play well on a given weekend, as he clearly did at Pebble Beach fairly recently. You know, he hasn't been a super consistent factor in the world's biggest tournaments, but he really showed up this week. What are some of your takeaways about the Justin Rose Ryder Cup of 2023?
Well, first of all, on Liv, I think actually what it did was it removed any awkwardness from Europe in terms of how you phase those players out. It's really difficult to leave out players like Sergio Garcia from the Ryder Cup. I think there would have been outrage had he remained eligible and not been selected. And actually, all those problems were taken away from Luke Donald. And in a way, it was the US who had to answer those questions, because their players were eligible. And they had, particularly Bryson DeChambeau, obviously the way he played the last couple of months, someone sort of banging loudly on the door. So it just shows you how much can change in 2 years. As for Justin Rose, I think one of my very favorite things in sport in general is seeing guys answer questions and remind you of their class in any sport, at any level, really. But Rose in particular, you know, he's got a fabulous Ryder Cup record. He's a major champion, a world number one. He's done most things in this game. He should really be a Masters champion as well, obviously. He really has achieved most things in this game. He's held massive putts at big moments. And I think his character is one that relishes that role he was given. And again, we come back to Luke Donald. And okay, it might seem obvious. What would you do with Justin Rose? And to put him in that role where he can guide someone through, very much as Graham McDowell did with Victor Dubuisson at Glen Eagles back in 2014, that was a task given to Rose. And it was an important task in a way that he was never going to be able to play five matches. It would have been appropriate for him to do that. And I think he was rewarded for doing that so well by going out quite early on Sunday in the singles, whereas I would have thought he might have been one of the last guys on the course. And actually, although he lost his singles match to a brilliant Patrick Cantlay, the putts he holed late in that match to keep it going were phenomenal. And I think, you know, ultimately he's been vindicated. And look, this is not, it doesn't have to be a big, you know, it's not right or wrong. Everybody makes their own choices in life, but his choice was very, very clear. He could give up on his Ryder Cup future and join Liv and make a heck of a lot of money and take one big payday, as others have chosen to do. Or he could go the other direction. And that other direction came with no guarantees. When he made that decision, he was not in the world's top 50. He was not on the Ryder Cup radar. So to go and make that decision and commit to that idea and then achieve it is spectacular. And, you know, Rose is a player I've made plenty of jokes at in the past. You know, we all know the logo, even when he shouldn't be wearing a logo and all the rest of it. But I think, you know, as we've seen with the Rose Lady series in the UK that came about during the pandemic and gave female golfers a platform and a place to go and earn some money, I think his heart is in the right place. And it was focused on getting back in this Ryder Cup side. And I, for one, am very, very happy that it worked out so well.
Now, there were also some potentially squeaky wheels on the European side, some rookies, some players who have not yet been proven really in professional golf that much or over that long a period of time, and certainly not in the Ryder Cup. And so those were to my eye, Bob McIntyre, Ludwig Aubert, and I'm going to go with that pronunciation, and Nikolai Højgaard. Sepp Straka, also a new face, but 30 years old and a relative veteran. Those three players that I just mentioned, a little more green, needed to be guided through this Ryder Cup by people like Justin Rose a bit more, but perhaps future stalwarts of the team. How would you evaluate their performance this week?
Well, McIntyre, first of all, obviously was the one who ended up being the most successful of them. 2.5 points, one of three unbeaten players. I think above anybody's expectations, if I can say that safely. I was, you know, he tried his hardest to get into this team 2 years ago and he didn't make it. He really committed to what he and his team felt was the best path into this team, i.e. via the European points list this year, because statistically he really wasn't one of the best 12, but he qualified and therefore his place is earned. Clearly, Rose played a massive part. I mean, Bob really didn't play well on Friday. He hadn't been playing well in practice. He'd had a poor weekend at the French Open. But I do think he's got something intangible about him. I think it's something we saw in the Scottish Open when he was so unfortunate to lose to Rory. And I'm not at all surprised that he could do it on his own against Wyndham Clark. And that was a fantastic performance. You know, who knows what the future holds for him? He's going to have to take his game up another level, I think, to still be in this team in 2 years. But he might be able to do that. He has so much talent and flair and a real sense of purpose. And I have a lot of time for him, and I'm sure a lot of people have. I think Nikolai was probably the disappointment. You know, he wasn't necessarily at his best. He did still hold some clutch putts. I'd love to know what Xander said to him as they did the sort of guard of honor thing afterwards, because he seemed to have a really good word in his ear. And I'm sure there were some really positive things said there, unless they were talking about money, who knows. And as for Ludwig, I suppose for Ludwig, I quite like that he was really disappointed when he came off the course, having lost to Brooks Koepka, who obviously in singles golf is yet to lose in the Ryder Cup. It was a tough draw for Ludwig in some respects, although Brooks had played poorly. I think it's kind of nice that there's been a slight sense that he's back down to earth, because, okay, he's gone into the Ryder Cup record books 4 or 5 months after turning professional. He's already won on the DP World Tour. This week, he's going to be the favorite for a PGA Tour event. Everything has come pretty easily. But over the last few weeks, he's obviously surrendered the lead at Wentworth. And after a perfect start to the Ryder Cup, he ended feeling that, okay, this isn't all going to come easily to me. And that will probably be a good thing in the long run for him. Rory said he'd be part of 15 or 20 Ryder Cups. I'm not sure it'll quite be that many. I think we may have got
a little bit lost at the moment there. But how old's he going to be? 20 yeah, right. Ryder Cups from now. He's going to be, 58, 62, around there.
He really is.
Maybe.
Really is the
Who
real
knows?
Deal.
he seems like a healthy young man. So we'll see.
Absolutely. But yeah, so look, you can't ask for a lot more than what he achieved on debut. I think some people were expecting even more, such is the regard in which he's held, such is his talent. And I think, I'm sure if you were to ask Brooks Koepka what he thinks of Ludwig Aaberg, he would have only good things to say, and he did fight hard in that match. So yeah, look, the story of the European team really was that the big three did what they needed to do, and the weaker three did more than some people expected, I think, and that all adds up to a win.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the leadership and the organization on the European side. This was a point of distinction potentially with the American side, even though the story recently, and there is some validity to this, is that the U.S. side has picked up a little bit of the some of the techniques that Europe has used in recent years in the Ryder Cup. But it seems like still Europe has the lead in that category. So starting with Luke Donald, you mentioned one decision that could have potentially come back to bite him in not playing Jon Rahm in all five sessions. And so if Europe happened to lose this Ryder Cup, if a couple of matches swung the other way, maybe we would be questioning more of his decisions. But what do you think is the core of what Donald did really well?
I suppose two things. One is that commitment to the statistics and to the data. And I think That's really how Luke Donald became the world's best player. You know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know this, but essentially, rather than do what a lot of people with his skill set do and try and get good at the thing you're not good at, Luke Donald, through working with people like Eduardo Molinari, realized that what he had to do was get really good at the things he was already good at. And he took that all the way to the very top of the sport. And it's, you know, clearly that was always going to be the color of his captaincy, to invest in that idea, to have a particularly close bond with Dodo, who obviously is a very sharp mind and someone who is helping members of this European team and help Matt Fitzpatrick become a major champion. I think you can see a real distinction in the way he talks about data and the way Zach Johnson talks about data. And although Luke Donald at his heart will also know that data is one part of a bigger picture, Zach Johnson almost seemed to be saying that as an excuse, really to use the data to confirm what he already wants to do. When the data disagreed with him, I suspect Zach Johnson moved away from it, whereas Luke Donald would use it to look again. So that was first and foremost. The second thing, I mean, I suppose, you know, the character of the man, he's very, very popular. He's always been popular. He speaks well. I thought his opening ceremony speech, although basically a waste of time, I thought he did that expertly. It was really touching. But I also think that he understands understood what he had to do with his team, which, you know, things are changing in Europe. We had a guy on the team who was raised in Georgia, but he made them a team. And the Hero Cup in January was a small part of that. Sepp Straka coming over to play in that certainly will have helped. Even down to those details of getting these guys in three balls at Wentworth together, all 12 members of that team playing at Wentworth, playing in groups with people they're going to be working with. It's an attention to detail, but also an understanding that you can't win a Ryder Cup just on numbers and on course setup and on moving a tee box. You've got to have a shared purpose, right? And he conjured that. And it's quite easy to do that with Europeans, I suppose. But you've got new faces coming in every time. And to get them all in that same mindset is no small achievement. And whether he takes it again in 2 years or not, I don't know. I do think what's happened with Liv gives Europe the excuse to go and try something they wouldn't previously have done. We don't have that line of succession, I suppose. But the other thing I would say is that I think Europe, and Donald's a bad example of this because he was a world number one, but Europe is probably that bit more willing to look beyond achievement on the course than the United States are when it comes to a captain. And Paul McGinley's a great example of that. Thomas Bjorn, even. These are not golfers who reach the very, very top of the sport. And when people say, well, I don't see where the next European captain is, we've got no McDowell, we've got no Poulter. Well, Dodo Molinari, Francesco Molinari, Nicholas Kolsarts. And Kolsarts is a great example because to a lot of casual golf fans, who is Nicholas Kolsarts? Really, they sort of vaguely remember him playing well for a bit of the Ryder Cup in 2012. They might remember he used to be a bit of a party boy. But Luke Donald, I think the words he used yesterday were, he's one of the best people I've ever met. And it's those characters that Europe is invested in, whereas the United States seem to feel that you are defined by what you achieved as a player. And only through that can you go on to achieve great things as a captain. And I think we've proven that to be completely the wrong way to think about it.
Yeah, I mean, and one indication that the U.S. side was moving beyond this was the appointment of Steve Stricker as a captain and his very effective reign as a captain. Steve Stricker, obviously very accomplished on the course, and indeed every captain who's ever been a Ryder Cup captain is very accomplished on the course, but there are different degrees. It used to be the case that, especially on the U.S. side, you needed to have a major or two to even be considered. And obviously, that has nothing to do with how effective you are as a captain. That's been proven over and over. Paul McGinley is one of the best captains in the history of the Ryder Cup, and he perhaps has the thinnest resume of any Ryder Cup captain. If you look at other sports, the great coaches are not necessarily great players. They're often players, and they often got the best out of their ability. But Greg Popovich, Bill Belichick, I mean, you know, these are not necessarily the cream of the crop when it comes to players, whereas a lot of really great players didn't end up being effective coaches. And so we should know that there is no correspondence really between super elite playing ability and super elite coaching or captaining ability. But it seems like, of course, Europe is learning that lesson a little quicker than the U.S. is, as Europe has learned these lessons traditionally more quickly when it comes to organization and leadership than the U.S. side has. Now, you mentioned that there's this possibility that Luke Donald could be captain again at Bethpage in 2025. Do you think he should be? Should they start to move toward more of a term structure when it comes to captains, as opposed to a one-off bit of service?
I think they should. I think if I was Luke Donald, I'd be, maybe I'm just too negative a person, but I think I'd be slightly wary of trying to repeat something like that, right? It's a moment in time, a period in his life. He's given a lot to it. You know, he's a dad and he's got other things going on, and it's a big commitment. So I don't know whether in the cold light of day, when things have settled down, whether he would really want to or would be wise to do it again. But in terms of Europe and having the best chance to succeed at Bethpage, which will be a phenomenally difficult thing to do, I think selecting Donald nice and early would give us the best chance of doing that. So obviously, as a European fan, I would like to see that happen. But the real message for me is that if it doesn't, then actually, although there, as I said, there may not be obvious options waiting in the wings, there are plenty of good ones. And look, Luke might do what Thomas Bjorn has done and make a really handy vice captain for somebody else. So I think it's probably quite possible that it is offered to him again. As I say, I wouldn't be certain he'll take it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Would they want to? We're talking about, you know, should captains serve for two terms or two events? But it is quite a commitment. You know, you see what these captains do when they're not, you know, at the Ryder Cup in the couple of years leading up. Now, of course, Luke Donald was a replacement captain for Henrik Stenson, and so he didn't even, you know, have that full period of time where he was working, which in a way makes what he accomplished here even more impressive. Now, you know, one particular thing that you can point to between Europe and the U.S. when it comes to leadership, one thing that we know about, right? We can speculate about what happened in the team room or what Dodo Molinari said to Luke about particular data. We don't know all of those details ourselves from the outside, but one thing that we can point to as a difference between the two sides is how the players approached the lead up to this Ryder Cup, how the team approached the lead up. The U.S. players really were left to make the decision on their own, whether they were going to play at the Fortinet Championship or at the BMW PGA Championship or do really any competitive preparation whatsoever for the Ryder Cup. The U.S. team did visit Marco Simone. Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay were not along for that trip, and they didn't have the excuse that Jordan Spieth had that they were having a kid or something like that. They just weren't there because they wanted to do something else. But at least there was that for the U.S. Europe did something like that themselves, and they also all played at the BMW PGA Championship, every last one of them, and they played well. And so there was a distinct, you know, there was a distinct difference between how these teams prepared for this cup. Do you think that that's a major thing that we should remember about, you know, why the outcome happened as it happened?
I think it's one of the most likely contributing factors without having any sense of certainty about that. I mean, you put it down on paper, you've got 12 guys who basically hadn't played a lot of golf. You know, obviously Justin Thomas, Max Homer and Brooks Koepka would be the exceptions. You know, 11 rounds between them in the month of September, I think it was. And by the way, one of those was the standout player on the US side. Now, again, that's neat and it doesn't tell the full story. But effectively, this Ryder Cup was lost in the very first session when Europe were absolutely ready to go and the United States weren't. And I think part of that the question has to be asked, why did they not play? And I hope it's asked seriously behind the scenes. I understand why in a press conference afterwards, you wouldn't go down that road. And I think the US press conference was really good, actually, and showed a togetherness that a lot of people did not necessarily believe was there. But ultimately, in the aftermath, there are a number of things you have to reflect on. And okay, great, if you got the team spirit right, well, that almost makes it harder to understand why did these 12 world-class golfers not perform. If there were no problems in the changing rooms, the golf course for me is not a very good excuse. Europe will have maximized every possible advantage in terms of tee box and routing even, but it's not a sufficient excuse because Marco Simone is not Paris National. So then we come back to why were these guys ready to perform? And the answer was clearly no. And I think a good explanation is that they didn't play. And the thing that really sums it up for me is it's really not about how much we can gauge or whether we are fully invested in the belief that they played poorly because they hadn't played. But it's the idea that any of them could turn up there and think that that's okay. That's what I can't get my head around. Rory McIlroy alluded to it. He said, I cannot imagine turning up a Ryder Cup after 5 weeks off. And that seems so obvious. I mean, who can imagine it? It seems remarkable to me. And the fact is they do not do this before majors. And yeah, okay, the majors happen in the season. This is post-season for the United States players. I get that. But there are places you can play golf. Whether the DP World Tour wanted to issue 12 invites to let them warm up at Wentworth, I don't know. Maybe they'd have played hardball with that. But the Fortinet Championship was an option, and a good option. It's competitive golf. You hear these guys talk about it all the time. You know, you go back and read the transcripts for the Houston Open and back in the day when it used to be the week before the Masters, and you'll hear guys saying, yeah, just wanted to get scorecard in my hand, make sure I'm ready for next week. Whether it's there, whether it's the Texas Open, whether it's the Scottish Open the week before the Open Championship now, whether it's the John Deere Classic, as Zach Johnson and Jordan Spieth know all too well, help them prepare to win the Open. Playing golf is what you need to do to be sharp, and they would not sacrifice that for themselves. So the fact that they would sacrifice it for the Ryder Cup, I find very hard to believe or understand. And I think it speaks to a simple difference at the core of this, which is that the Europeans care just that little bit more. I really think that's true.
Yeah, and I believe that. I also think that there's an additional dynamic here. And that is that a big part of the task force era on the U.S. side has been this kind of move toward player empowerment or toward individualized planning for each of the players. Because I think that a lot of leaders on the U.S. side are convinced that part of the problem with the 2014 Ryder Cup and with Tom Watson's leadership there is that he tried to fit everybody into the same mold and get the whole team doing the same thing and went about this in a kind of dictatorial way where he was suppressing the individual differences between players and not allowing them to be different or to do what they do well as individual athletes. And so a big part of what Davis Love and company have been working on is figuring out how to let players be themselves at these Ryder Cups. But of course, on the European side, it seems like this is not as much of a conflict that you can ask all of them to show up at the BMW PGA Championship, and that's not some big offensive thing to their individuality or to who they are as players or to their own expertise about what they need to prepare for the Ryder Cup. They just do it and they're there as a team, and some of them play better than others, but this is what they're doing. It doesn't seem like the U.S. team is capable of doing that, because at every turn, there are players who are like, oh, well, that's not how I like to do it. Even down to the type of water that they like to drink. The leaders of the U.S. team were concerned with that. One guy likes Fiji water and another guy likes smart water, I guess. And that's a big deal. And all this stuff, you know, it seems convincing when you think in terms of all of these guys are experts at their own games, and what they do well is be individual golfers. That's how they perform. And so it kind of makes sense to try to provide a structure where they can do that. But the problem is that doesn't always work. And when you have an issue like, how should we prepare competitively for the Ryder Cup, given that there is this substantial gap between the Tour Championship and the Ryder Cup, maybe there is some kind of team-wide decision-making, some collective action that is necessary in that case where you say, okay, Xander, Patrick, you may not want to do this, but this is what we're doing as a team, and we're going to ask you to fit your individual personality and planning into this larger plan. Can you find a way to do that? Can you find a way to adjust just a little bit to do something as a team? It seems like the European players can do that, and that the American players don't think that they have to do that, or in fact, they think that that hurts them.
Absolutely. And one of the examples for me would be that, you know, Patrick Cantlay being allowed to skip the gala dinner. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine any European wanting to skip the gala. This is a real privilege. You know, you might not like pomp and ceremony and eating really nice food. I understand that. I'm sort of in some way in agreement with that idea that you might just want a quiet night in a hotel room. But this is 1 week of your life. This is what we do. We're all going to be there as a team. Patrick Cantlay, having had neck ache and not slept very well the night before, is a hideously weak excuse. But the fact that he's looking for that excuse, I think, is what tells us that there's a problem there. And I think it's all the more jarring this year when your 13th man was probably Keegan Bradley, someone who would do anything to be on that team. And I do feel sorry for Keegan, actually. If you have got guys, and a story's come out today about Xander Schauffele and a dispute over some financial aspect of a deal that, you know, may or may not have kept him off the team had things gone differently, it's hard not to feel that, you know, you've got guys who actually want to be there. And that's what it really comes down to, the people who want to be there versus the people who really don't mind either way. And that's a really big thing. And what it means is that Europe have foundations in place and a general mindset of being able to overachieve. The United States' achievement in the Ryder Cup is limited to their abilities. Now, fortunately, they are extremely capable golfers. And that's why, you know, in 2 years' time, they will very probably win back the Ryder Cup, or at least they'll have a very good chance to do that. But if they want to win away, you know, it is a long, long time now. It'd be 34 years. If they want to do that, you have to do things. You have to sacrifice. You have to do things that can make you a little bit better as a team than you are as individuals. And there are loads of things to that. I'm sure, you know, Luke Donald would have a far better understanding of that than me, but the American team structure needs to understand it as well. And it needs to spend time talking with the players and getting that point of view across. And if there are players who refuse to accept it, then they simply shouldn't be playing. It really seems that straightforward. And it's one of those things. We have a qualification system, and that's what it is. But in other sports, I mean, you mentioned some American football coaches, I believe, earlier. So I'm going to mention a
basketball and a football coach. Yeah, I'm sorry. I was trying to think of a soccer coach, like Pep Guardiola. I don't know if he was a good soccer player or not. So I really can't speak on or cricket for that matter.
Well, I mean, probably the best example, despite my being an Arsenal fan, is Sir Alex Ferguson, a great football manager over here, a very good player himself, but a great football manager. And he had all the power, effectively. And when he had a great football player who did not fit in with his team, that football player left the club for the greater good. And I suppose in Ryder Cup terms, it's not that simple. Zach Johnson could not have left Brian Harman at home. Obviously, Brian Harman's a bad example there because I'm sure he was fully invested. But he didn't really have that choice. And I mean, maybe that's one option they can look at in future. But let's just pick the 12 players we want to pick that we believe will make a team. Because any system where people are turning up who don't necessarily want to be there. And on that, clearly they want to be, once they're there, they want to win. They're competitors. And we saw that from Patrick Cantlay. Of course, he's going to want to win that match on Saturday night. Of course, he wants to beat Justin Rose. But that's not really the whole of wanting to be there. Wanting to be there is wanting to be a teammate, is being willing to sit out a session, is being willing to play with Brooks Koepka or Brian Harman or whoever. Doesn't have to be with, as Justin Rose put it, doesn't have to be with your best mate. It's making those sacrifices. And until the US as a whole show that they're willing to do that, or a captain shows that he's willing to make them do that. And obviously, as you said, Tom Watson kind of tried and maybe that backfired. There has to be a middle ground. And that's what good management is, right? But being able to manage difficult personalities, big egos, world-class individuals, and make them into a coherent team. And I think really that's where Zach fell short, but he's not alone. And, you know, the players take a good deal of responsibility as well.
Yeah. And this middle ground that you mentioned is the key part, because we're not saying that everybody needs to be the same type of player or do the exact same thing at the Ryder Cup. These are individual athletes and they know what they need, but there needs to be a little bit of give there. Just a little bit, right? We need to be able to meet halfway just a bit and not just make the captain somebody who is constantly accommodating. Now, one thing we haven't talked about is the Rory versus Lakava situation. And, you know, I'm not that interested in getting super deep into it because there are a million other podcasts that you can listen to that will probably do a blow-by-blow of that. They've already talked about it. Brendan and Andy have already talked about it in a great way on the Shotgun Start. But I thought that one really interesting thing about that situation was how Luke Donald handled it. You know, I would imagine that the expectation for an American captain would be that he would come out and beat his chest with the media and fully get behind his player and say, yeah, he was justified and I'm right there with him. And that's the accommodating, way of dealing with that kind of situation as a leader, saying that every single thing that any player does, I completely agree with. I don't think Luke Donald really took that approach. He was more like, you know, I'll have a discussion with Rory about it and we'll move on from there. And so it didn't seem like Luke Donald felt the need to show Rory, oh, I completely support you. I'm right there with you. I'm in this fight with you. He didn't do that. And you have to respect that because it's clear that Donald wasn't just there to be an advocate for his players. He was an advocate for the team as a whole.
Absolutely. I mean, they said that there's no hierarchy. And although that's not true in practicality, of course, there is a hierarchy. There's a range of abilities. The essence of the message is that, you know, this is the team and this is what you do and this is what I expect. And if anybody falls out of line, then there'll be repercussions. And I agree with you totally. The way he responded on Saturday night, I thought it was a really good idea to diffuse it a little bit. And I think it's a very different response to you've got from maybe even a Padraig Harrington. Whistling Straits, you know, certainly a Thomas Bjorn, but a number of captains previously would have dealt with that very, very differently. Because I think ultimately, again, without going into the detail, I think Rory was probably very justified in his anger, if not the way he displayed it. And it would have been very easy for Luke Donald to come out and say that's simply not acceptable of a caddy, but he didn't. And I thought, although Victor Hovland seemed to suggest that that wasn't a message that had been got across to them, and I know there's, you know, everyone prepares differently and Rory was reading on the bus and all this stuff, but I thought there was a real, it was really interesting to see the demeanor of all of the European players on Sunday. It was as if they'd learned some lessons from even Rory against Patrick Reed at Hazeltine and conserved a little bit of energy. It was a determined reaction to everything that went right. It was a very similar aesthetically fist bump. It was not a whipping up of the crowd. It was business and focus and determination. And again, I think that in some way, whether it was a directive or not, in some way that comes back down to the captain and the mood that he set in that team room about getting the job done. And they did him proud in the end.
Ben Coley, thank you for coming on the podcast. People can find your work at sportinglife.com. You have a really good 5 takeaways article that you wrote just today, I believe, on there. And we ran through some of that material in this discussion. But it's always fun to read your work and always fun to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Garrett. It's been fun again.
This episode of the Friday Golf Podcast was produced by Matt Ruscius. Thank you very much, Matt. One thing that you can do, a simple thing, to support Friday Golf is just rate and review the Friday Golf Podcast. Have you been enjoying what you've been hearing from this podcast this year? If so, go and give us a rating. Tell us what you think of the show in your review. Give us some feedback. Just doing that helps us find new listeners and slowly help this podcast grow. All right, thank you for listening, and we'll be back again soon with another episode.